One part frog parts, one part embedded design, and one part fish fry. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. And yes, we will be covering embedded design and frog parts this week. So let's start with the latter, because I know you're wondering about that, right? So maybe parts is a strong term to be using here. It's actually just the embryos that are creating a new form of life. Yes, you heard me right. A new form of life. So folks, it's time for a little news you may have missed. Xenobots edition. So what are these xenobots? Well, they are a millimeter-sized living programmable organism. They are not robots or any known species of animal. They are a completely new class of artifact. So let's start at the beginning and head on over to the University of Vermont, where a group of research scientists have, get this, programmed, repurposed living cells scraped from frog embryos with a little help from a specialized algorithm to create a new type of being that could eventually be used for intelligent drug delivery and maybe a whole lot more. Okay, so before we head into the frog embryos, how they're programmed, or the super cool stuff they'll be able to do, we have to start with that algorithm, right? Okay, enter the Deep Green Supercomputer Cluster at the Vermont Advanced Computing Core and lead author and doctoral student Sam Kriegman, who created a revolutionary new algorithm that created thousands of simulated designs for new life forms. Then the supercomputer cluster used that algorithm to assemble and reassemble a few hundred simulated cells into a whole bunch of different body forms and shapes. And as the algorithm trucked along, driven by basic rules about the biophysics of what a single frog skin and cardiac cells could do, failed designs were discarded, and the more successful simulated organisms were kept and refined. After only a few hundred runs of this algorithm, the team had a set of very promising designs for testing. And then it was time for real life and real cells. So next, a team of researchers from Tufts University took over and brought along some African frogs, or specifically the Xenopus laevis, hence the Xenobot's name. So first, this team from Tufts harvested stem cells from the embryos of these little froggies, and then separated those cells into single cells, and then left those to incubate. And then those cells were then cut and joined together using the teeniest of forceps and a very tiny electrode, according to the design specified by the algorithm. And get this, these cells over time began to work together, eventually allowing these xenobots to move on their own and in a coherent fashion. And get this, when they were turned over, the xenobots failed, just like bugs on their back. Okay, so they can move around. Great. But later tests showed that these xenobots could actually push pellets around as well in their watery environments, both simultaneously and collectively. When some of these xenobots were purposely built with a hole in the center to reduce drag, it was found that these new holy xenobots could essentially carry an object. This team from the University of Vermont is certain that this new research is a huge step toward using computer-designed organisms for intelligent drug delivery. But not just that. This team believes that building these xenobots is also a small step toward cracking what the team calls the morphogenic code that should provide a deeper view of the overall way organisms are organized and how they compute and store information based on their histories and environment. But this research does pose a whole bunch more new questions and challenges,
Michael Levin, co-leader of this project, who directs the Center of Regenerative and Developmental Biology at Tufts, puts it like this. The big question in biology is to understand the algorithms that determine form and function. The genome encodes proteins, but transformative applications await our discovery of how that hardware enables cells to cooperate toward making functional anatomies under very different conditions. Wow. Guys, there is so much more to this story. I could spend an hour talking about it, but we've got more fish to fry. So if you want to read even more information about this groundbreaking, cell-busting new research and how this team of researchers have created a scalable pipeline for designing reconfigurable organisms, of course, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page with more information. All right, it's time to bring in my guest for this week. Please welcome Dunstan Power from Bitesnap Design. Dunstan and I are getting out our embedded design crystal ball and looking at the future. Let's go. Hi, Dunstan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi.
Okay, so today we are taking a closer look at some embedded design trends for 2020. So let's start off with one of my favorites, which seems to be gaining more and more traction these days, AI and machine learning.
Yeah, I mean, it is the hot topic at the moment. I mean, AI is getting so much press and there's so many sort of companies, startups and large established companies embracing it that it's become almost a bit of a joke, really, because what AI means to one company and another mean different things. But I think what I'd say is, in general, when people are talking about AI, they really mean machine learning. So that's effectively getting a machine to replicate what a human would do in a particular scenario. I mean, that's a sort of approximate. So we focus mainly on embedded devices. So what we're really seeing is AI at the edge. So this is really where you're using machine learning to get an embedded device. So something that's out there in an industrial situation or an aircraft or whatever to perform the AI function rather than necessarily connecting to the cloud and getting a server to do it. So this gives you the advantage of reducing the amount of data that you're having to pass back and forth. It reduces latency. And so you don't have to have a network. You can work offline. And sort of the example project that we've seen is with an agricultural machine where the blades get dulled over time as they're cutting. You get vibrations in the motor. And what this customer is doing, basically to look at the typical vibrations when the blades are sharp and then to track those as the blades dull, get blunter, so that they can basically get an alert that there's a problem early on rather than the machine just stopping working or jamming up, basically. So it's that type of thing. And certainly a lot of the applications we're seeing are around motors and industrial drives and vibrations. That seems to be the initial sort of area that this is coming in on.
So I've also heard that we will be seeing a big push into machine learning driven tools by Xilinx and Intel. So what does that landscape look like going forward, do you think?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. So Xilinx and Intel, who bought Altera, they're the two leading FPGA providers. And really, in terms of large FPGAs that can go into data centers and really do powerful stuff, what we're seeing is that both companies are taking this area really seriously. They see it as a place they can get big sales in the future and for some of their more expensive devices where they have a really large margin. And what Xilinx are doing in particular is they're abstracting the machine learning approach really away from what we could treat as traditional FPGA engineers, and they're abstracting it so that they've got tools and software and hardware that can be used by software engineers and people who wouldn't traditionally necessarily use FPGAs. And they're actually bringing out products which aren't development boards, so not the traditional FPGA company hardware sale. These are actual real products that can get put into server farms and be used for machine learning and AI functions.
I've also been hearing a lot about RISC-V these days, but I know there isn't much actual hardware for RISC-V right now. So, do you see that changing in 2020? And what else do you see happening in the world of RISC-V?
Yeah, I mean, RISC-V, it's a new kid on the block, and it's really a big threat to ARM in particular. It's basically ARM are completely dominant in embedded, absolutely, across all the sectors that we deal in. And they operate on this traditional licensing model. And RISC-V is shaking things up because it allows startups, small companies, new players to quickly use IP that they can own. They don't need to license, and they can adapt, they tweak it themselves, and get into the market and take on some of the big boys. And what we're seeing is that the big companies are looking over their shoulder at this, and they're investing themselves in RISC-V so they don't get left behind. But really, the people who are pushing forward with it, they're Far Eastern companies, they're startups, they're not household names generally. And these are the guys that this is going to be the thing we watched in 2020 to see whether these companies are successful getting market traction over the huge dominance that ARM currently enjoys. We at Bytesnap, we've got our first RISC-V chips in the office, and we've ported some of our graphic user interface software onto it to try it out, really, just to see how it fares up against the ARM devices. So I don't expect in 2020 that RISC-V is going to seriously weaken ARM. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see it by the end of the year, just whether any of the big chip manufacturers are bringing out RISC-V cores. I think really the real key moment will be when a handset comes out, which is based largely around a RISC-V instruction set processor. I think we're quite a long way from that at the moment, but certainly within the next 3 to 5 years, I'd expect to see that.
I'm sure you will agree with me, but I see security playing a bigger and bigger role in 2020, especially in the realm of IoT and embedded design in general. So do you think we'll be seeing that as well?
Yes. So security has gone from being something that people add on to the end of a project to something that customers, they talk about from day one, or we bring up at day one, because it's a lot easier if you consider it from the start of a project than if you try and just leverage it in at the end. So there's been a lot of press around vulnerabilities in devices and in software, and some of it's hype and some of it's reality. So, for instance, you see articles about hacks where it involves somebody sitting outside a house in a van for days at a time with a supercomputer, basically having to directly access the Wi-Fi network of the house, and then they're able to turn a light on and off. And we shouldn't really conflate that with what I consider to be real security threats, where you get large numbers of IoT devices getting taken over and used in a botnet, for instance. And this is where the real security issues are with IoT. It's around the internet-connected device, rather than necessarily some very esoteric local devices, say, taking over a car's tire pressure monitoring system, which involves actually driving alongside the car for hours at a time. The main change really now is just customers and chip manufacturers considering this security right from the outset of a project and just building it in all the way through.
Lastly, you're from Bytesnap Design. So for my audience who may not know about Bytesnap, what are you guys all about?
Yeah, well, we're an electronic and software product design company. We're based in the UK. We've got an international client base, and we're in lots of market sectors, but we particularly focus on embedded devices. So this is things like industrial control, medical devices, aftermarket automotive, that type of thing. So it's devices designed for specific use. We've been going 12 years, and we're enjoying real growth, and we're involved in lots of exciting projects at the moment. And certainly, if you've got any listeners who are looking, got a technical challenge they need help with, look us up.
Okay, Dunstan, now it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, I know you haven't been on my show before, so here's your standard off-the-cuff. You have one last meal on planet Earth. That's all. That's all you're going to eat for the rest of your life. What would it be?
It'd have to be roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, roast potatoes, gravy and carrots, a traditional British Sunday roast.
Excellent, and that sounds super good right about now. Well, Dunstan, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, hosted by yours truly. And by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can check out our Fish Fry archive, or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of January 17th, 2020, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.